Hello, friends. Welcome to the End Evil podcast. This is Chris Jansen, and evil is the destruction of freedom. I hope you folks are working on some form or another in your life to end evil, to find ways to stop being part of the stealing, being part of the dogmatic belief systems that are holding us down as humanity. And if you haven't yet, I want you to check out this book, The End of All Evil. You can get it by going on my website, andevil.life. And when you order the book, you also get these awesome stickers, And Evil podcast stickers. I've been putting them on everything. Look, if I see some evil corporate logo, like, look, there's one right there on my shirt. Just cover it up with the End Evil podcast sticker, just like that. Also, if you haven't yet, get onto the email list for End Evil Connect. We're going to work on setting up another private mastermind group for those who are interested. Go on the andevil.life and find the contact me page and send me an email and say I want to be part of End Evil Connect. All right, folks, I'm going to get this show started in just a second here, but thanks for joining me. I'm really excited to share this episode with Sarah Cross. I really enjoyed my conversation with Sarah, and I think she's an inspiration to all of us. So let's enjoy the show. Thanks, folks. My computer's going to do something really funny to me right now. It's giving me a hard time. All right, let's see if we can get this working. No, it's really misbehaving. Well, I guess since I'm live and I can't stop it right now, I'm just going to also say that it's an ongoing struggle trying to work out technology and keep the End Evil podcast coming to everyone. So one of the things I've been struggling with sometime is this video camera, which isn't quite of the caliber I would like. So I am looking for anyone who's interested in helping with some donations to the show, because we do need a new End Evil podcast camera. So yeah, if anyone could help with that, that'd be great. But right now, my mouse is not responding, and my computer seems to be on stuck. So bear with me, friends, and we'll try to get this working.
Welcome to the End Evil podcast. Evil is the destruction of freedom. Thanks for coming, folks. I just want to remind you to get over to endevil.life and click on the button to join the newsletter for End Evil Connect. And so you can stay in tune with what's going on End Evil podcast and the great things we have coming up. I'm really excited to share some inspiration with you today. I have a good friend with me, Sarah Cross. Thanks so much for joining me, Sarah Cross. You've been a big inspiration and you gave me that kick I needed to get my book going, and it's almost done. And I really appreciate that. And I got your book and started reading it and have been listening to some of your stuff. So I'm really excited to share you with the End Evil listenership tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I'm glad that I could be here and that I could be of help.
Well, I think it is helpful to be inspired, because where else do you draw inspiration but from other people who are inspiring? And I think sometimes we do have to draw inspiration from ourselves, and that's partly one of the amazing things I think about you. And when I was thinking about you and your journey and some of the things I've learned about your life, it made me think of the word resilience. So I want to just share with the audience, resilience, the meaning comes from elasticity, the power of returning to original shape after compression, to rebound or recoil, to jump or leap. And I think this is the context of what we need to learn to do in today's world that beats us up from so many directions, whether it's health problems or financial problems or, you know, emotional issues. We're getting beat up in today's world, and we're trying to share truth and talk about freedom and individual sovereignty. So I'd like to see how, Sarah, what is the word resilience? How does that hit you?
Resilience to me, yes, there's, you know, the definition that you shared, but resilience is just refusing to, how would I put it? Resilience is always standing on your feet. Like that might be the best way I could put it. It's like resilience, you know, just holding your own all the time, despite the things that come at you. So I think just being, you know, resistant and being indomitable really are tools that help anybody who is fighting any kind of outside or internal struggle. So just despite whatever is coming at you, you're going to be resilient with your resolve and who you are, and like really stay focused in that. Because when you're like that, then it's very difficult for other things to really affect you too badly. To, when you know who you are, when you've got your thoughts, emotions, and actions in order, these are tools, internal tools that I think everybody should work on, and understand that. I also feel that you can't. Everything that's coming at you, it's also all influence. So when you allow influence to affect you in that way, this is when disaster really starts to happen. But if you're resilient in yourself and you've got your house in order, this really helps to combat a lot of that. And you can see a lot clearer. I don't know if that makes sense, but I guess that's how I might look at it.
I think it might help if folks don't already know Sarah Cross and a little bit about you. You're doing a show on the radio right now, Crosstalk. And I'd like you to share a little bit about that with people. But you've been through quite a journey in your life of some pretty heavy duty health problems that most of us don't face, especially not with the regularity you have since being born, sounds like. And I mean, gone through incredible obstacles and then written a book, and are now, you're out there trying to inspire other people. Cystic fibrosis, did I say it correctly? What you've been dealing with. And not only that, but all the other trials of life that you've gone through, you know, I heard a little bit about on some of your shows and starting to read your book, but incredible trials and obstacles you've been through that I think I'm going to propose that going through trials and things that push us to rise within ourselves and to meet these challenges create this warrior. And I feel like you're a warrior spirit because maybe partly because of all the trials you've been through. Do you think that could be the case?
It could be. yeah, I mean, excuse me.
Okay. I got my strawberries here.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think the concept of being a warrior is, you know, some people might think that as a little bit cheesy, but really the concept of it is about what we were talking, what we started with was being resilient, being indomitable, standing on your feet despite whatever comes at you, never kneeling to anything. And like, I'm in that mindset myself. I don't kneel to anything. I don't fear anything because fear will get at you at the worst, you know? So, the radio show, I talk a lot about history, about medical information. I try to be as thorough and factual as I possibly can on, you know, in my research. And yeah, like, you know, I think just being born with something that is quite rare. It is quite rare. It's like 40,000 people in the United States, maybe, are born with cystic fibrosis annual. Like, that's the number currently that they have, like, total, as a total number. Like, even global, it's only about, last time I checked, something like 170,000 people currently globally live with it. And it is a very unusual and rare condition. And I would just say on that to clarify that cystic fibrosis is something that you are born with. It is not a disease or an illness that you develop over time. It is a genetic mutation that disrupts, well, basically the short story is it disrupts the chloride function in your system, which can cause a variety of issues because it's dysfunctional and it's progressive. It's a mutation from the get-go. So, and there's a whole history about it that I go into the book and on my show about it. But yeah, I mean, that's where I'm coming from. I come from the view of dealing with very specific, difficult personal experiences that are uncommon, I think, for a lot of people. I mean, everybody has experiences that are difficult. And I think it's good to keep your mind open about where people are coming from, you know, their own personal histories. So.
Yeah, like the uniqueness of each of our journey is partly what forms who and what we are in the moment. And it's always changing. So folks, your book is An Addiction to Being Alive, A Life of Cystic Fibrosis and the Aftermath. And so we'll share that link so folks can check that out. And that's amazing, like becoming an author and being able to explain and share your story while you're going through the war of experience in your life. I feel like that's kind of a metamorphosis of a person that a lot of people don't go through. The growth of not just experiencing a thing, but then how do you help other people that might be experiencing that other thing? And I feel like that's kind of like the one great work that the missing link a lot of folks don't get, that the deeper challenge of the soul is not only to heal ourselves, but then to help other people heal themselves as well, because we do depend on one another. And we are a intermesh society. Like, we depend, humans depend on one another. And, but the strange thing I've noticed is yourself and so many people I know that become like close to me that I really cherish in my life are kind of like those contrarian personalities, I call them, people that ask why and never quite fit in for some reason or another. And I would expect that given with the health things you've dealt with or other various reasons in school or wherever you're going, there you're kind of getting separated from the herd. You're different than the other kids. You're different than the other people. And that gives you a unique skill, I think, in objectivity and looking at the world and looking at what people are doing. So curious what you might have to say on being a little different than everyone else.
Yeah, that can be extremely hard. It can be hard for people. That's why so many people during the lockdowns, there was a huge reporting of people just having like a lot of social issues, mental issues, like things were coming up for people because like of the isolation that they really like. I don't think anybody should have isolated anything, but themselves especially, like I didn't, and I'm considered, you know, one of the most vulnerable. there was a lot, like people find it very difficult to be alone, and that was definitely, you know, if that wasn't proved to people because it was out in the open, it was like, but being alone can be very difficult for people. And as a kid growing up myself with a condition that nobody understood, you know, kids are very cruel. They can be cruel. Adults can be cruel, even if it's unintentional. And to be isolated and put aside from your community is quite a difficult place to be in. I unfortunately got used to it. I got used to being able to be okay by being alone. I eventually like got used to this condition of like being alone for the majority. It's not like I was necessarily alone in all avenues of support that helped me. It's just when you have something that people don't understand and people just think doesn't exist, or, you know, you're classified as a freak as a result of it, you are alone. You're alone in here, in up here. And like, I mean, I've said it before, you know, I'm not too shy about it. I was a child of bullying from my kids my own age, from teachers and adults. But really, what's interesting about that is that I think what helped me to turn into who I am now, where I can be like this, I can be objective, I can look at all the corners, I can look into the dark realms, down the dark hallways, look at all the things and like try to be objective about everything and take everything in, is because I feel like in almost a way that kind of childhood experience of being alone and being put in hospitals and not really having too many, you know, friends and spending all my time in the public library and things like this. This helped me in order to really see and broaden my scope. I mean, again, this happened all when I was like more like a kid, but and as traumatic as a lot of that is, I think it did help develop me in the way of being able to do that and not shy away from it or throw anything out with the bathwater. I can look at everything and be okay. And, you know, as a result, I'm okay with being alone. I'm very comfortable with myself, which is also, I think, something people should work on. People should be okay with being comfortable with being alone because, you know, you're not particularly like a bad person. You're a developing person. So, and that's what people struggle with being alone, is that maybe they're not entirely okay with being alone by them, with themselves, with just themselves, not just by themselves, but with themselves. You know, you have to have all that together. And that takes a long time. And like, I probably had a push in that direction as a young kid. I don't, you know, recommend people just like barrel into like whatever traumatic situation to get to that point, but it can be very difficult to be, yeah, socially awkward, socially rejected. That's very hard. That's a very hard thing to have to go through, because it does feel like, and I don't know if I'm rambling a little bit too much here, Chris, so, but it does feel like you're being rejected and you're being thrown away. And that's something that people need to be mindful when they're interacting with people. Like, I do not support anything from any movement or from anybody who's going to choose to throw people away in, you know, mentally because of this one thing or that one thing that they said or whatever. You know, people are allowed to grow and change. And you know, people do. There were people who I had, you know, issues with as a kid, other kids who would, you know, harass me or bully me or whatever, because they didn't understand my condition, that kept me out of school a lot and made me look like, you know, I was sick all the time. You know, that was why I got bullied. But I've had kids who I went to school with, who are adults now, who have come back to me and said, you know what, I was wrong and I'm sorry. And that's okay. And we need to like keep those doors open to allow people to do that. So
this is so crucial what you're talking about, Sarah, and it's lighting me up because it's like advanced empathy skills. I've thought a lot about what develops empathy in a being, whether it's an animal or a human being. And when I watch animals, I think when they play together as babies, they begin to develop empathy because one scratches the other and the other one feels the scratch and says, oh, you don't want to feel that, huh? How about that? And the other one feels it and they're like, oh, that hurts. Okay, we don't want to, you know. And that's how they learn the limits of their fury, of how far you can push it. And little kids play together. Little boys always run around, beat each other up, and that drives the moms crazy. But it's very natural part. And I think relationships and the way we haven't been relating in communal settings through history, you can't survive out there in the woods on your own without a crew of some sort to help protect you from the wild animals and to gather food. It takes people working together to do that. And historically, if you got excommunicated, that's literally your survival's on the line. You're going to die out there. And so I think that is very much part of our genetic makeup and DNA understanding, that belonging to the group is survival. And for that reason, there's a deep desire in people to belong. And there, I think loneliness is prevalent in today's society because all these structures of evil have really impeded on our ability to work together, to commune together, to dance and sing together like people have done historically. And, you know, it's sad. But what you really talked about, though, deeper down was developing the self. And I've often wondered, how does Will come from? Where do we get that? And I think, like, in a way, here's my question for you. Does facing death bring us closer to truth? You know, do we have to face trauma or pain in order to realize things? Is that how it works?
I wouldn't be the end all, you know, expert in that kind of question, but I can answer it how I understand it. How I see it, because I've met so many different types of people, there's a small, tiny percentage of people, I would say, who can take what they learn and integrate it very easily. But I think that's a very small percentage of people. I think the rest of us have to really take a lot of time with it and get comfortable with the information that we take in. And that includes the information we get from others. It includes the information from our external world. It includes the information we're getting from ourselves. And I would say that as a practice, it's prudent to go inward and build that relationship with yourself, your high self or fraction of source or whatever people want to call it, because that's the real you. These are bodies. These are just rented vehicles we're in, these physical shells. Like, this is how I see this, because this is what makes sense to me. And through my own personal experiences and, you know, the resources that I've been able to read up to so far. So to answer your question, do people need to experience severe traumatic events? Do people need to experience death or, you know, dying, if I'm understanding the question right, in order to come to the truth? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I feel like that sometimes I'm imagining you, okay, here's like before our talk, I was kind of like imagining some of the situations you must have been in your life where you're like in a hospital bed somewhere. And I'm sure that sounds like you have had some amazing loved ones that have stood by you throughout tough times, but it seems like there must have been times where you were just kind of completely alone with yourself in the darkness and just trying to heal from who knows if you even can heal. You're being told you probably can't. And you're forced to look at the darkness alone all by yourself.
Yeah.
And that, I feel like that being on that precipice, this is something I'm trying to write in the book I'm writing, is what brings us closer to realizing, like, if you look through time, like shamans have like hung themselves by hooks on their chest, you know, in the sun until they have this experience to get closer to God, you know? And I guess that's what I'm getting at is
having difficult experiences that are very like, you know, spirit shattering events is a great sounding board for like figuring out that kind. Like, I'm sorry, like, that's like what it is. Like, I have experienced things in my life that other people would not understand. Not everybody would understand it, but I've had a couple of instances where I have been that close. And it's like shaking hands with death. Like, it feels like, not to sound poetic about it, but that's kind of what it feels like. And then you're in this place where you kind of change a little bit and you go, oh, I get it. Like, the thing is people are afraid of death. I think that the experiences that we have that are quite traumatic and really like push us to that edge, they do really help us to assimilate or assess objective truth. I feel like it does. That's what really a lot of that did it for me. I'm like, and what people are most afraid of, they think they're afraid of death. But really what they're afraid of is suffering and pain and the pain they go through when you're dying. That's what people are really afraid of. That's the fear. Death is fearless. And I say everybody should just run right into it. Be fearless. Even if it's terrifying, even if it's horrifying, even if it's you're scared, you know, be fearless about it anyway, because these experiences do change you. They changed me. And when I realized that I'm not afraid of death, I'm not even afraid of this anymore because I've assimilated it, or I don't know if that's the right term I want to use, but I've assessed it and I dealt with it. What I was afraid of was the pain that comes with dying. And when I realized that is a completely different thing entirely. It is completely different. And then you realize there's a separation there. And I guess it's kind of hard to explain, but that's really what happened to me.
You know, I get poison oak sometimes. And the times when I've had poison oak real bad, I've realized that exact thing you're saying. As uncomfortable as I am in the moment, that's not what's really stressing me out. What's stressing me out is that I don't know how long this is going to keep going and how much worse it's going to get. And I've realized that many times when I've gone through it, that's the biggest like stress and fear in my mind. It's like, how much longer? How worse is it going to get?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Like, I'm not afraid of poison oak. what I would be afraid of, I mean, I guess I'm using that word kind of loosely for general terminology, but what I would be afraid of is how long is this freaking discomfort going to last? Like, can we move on with it? I got, you know, things to do. So it's, you get like that after a while. That's probably why I come off the way that I do, because I'm not a fearful person. I'm just not. And I'm not, and you know, I don't, I guess maybe the kindest thing to say, I'm not like a bleeding heart. I don't know if that's kind, but I don't tend to do that really anymore. I have empathy, but I have empathy for what I think are the, you know, looking at the right, at the situation, you know, in the more clinical viewpoint, where it's like, I feel for your suffering, but I can kind of see, like, maybe if you do these things, you go through these steps, maybe you'll see what I see, that this is, you know, a growth experience. And on that note, I would say being pushed to that ledge, you know, it is a growth experience. It is a severe growth experience. You are being like, you're hanging from the cliff, like at that stage. And, you know, it just changes you. And like, I don't know if I know how to express that in all the right ways, but you could say that being fearless is being the fool, like in the tarot. That's how I am
standing at the edge of that cliff. We were just talking about that recently, the fool, you know, on that card you're talking about in the tarot card. He's kind of standing on the edge of the cliff, but it doesn't mean he falls off. You know, it's like we were talking about that. Like he's comfortable with being on the edge, you know, and I think there's something to be said for what is will. I've looked into that a lot and asked people questions. What is it? Where does will come from? Often it is that thing we're talking about, that fear of not becoming something we don't want to become, or having to experience something terrible that we don't want to experience, that drives our will to say, you know what, I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen to me or other people. And it kind of reminds me of that sword in the stone kind of symbolism too, where you, if you're trying to pull it out for ego, because you want to be the tough guy and you want to be the king, you know, it doesn't work. But when the dragon's about to eat all your friends, and you need to save their life and you're willing to give up everything, all of a sudden the sword pops out and you can slay the dragon. You know, it's like that you find that place within yourself when you need to. And a lot of times we don't push ourselves enough to need to. And modern culture and society will create a comfortable place where people can be all alone and still feel like they're not alone, because they got, you know, AI buddies and social media buddies and social media arguments. And, you know, it's like fake Netflix family that they spend their evenings with. But we're really lacking that pure connection. And one thing I've really vibrated with that you talk about when we've been in conversation, I know you've done other work too, like the Girls Club and been on multiple podcasts. Revolution Radio, I wanted to mention that before we get off later, but for people to know when Crosstalk happens, Revolution Radio, what day of the week is it?
That's Wednesdays. It's live Wednesdays from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And if you're on the Pacific Coast, it's 10 a.m. to 12 p.m.
And that's Studio A, doesn't it say, or something?
Studio like that? A, yeah.
Cool. But yeah, you know how to talk to people. And I've noticed that there's a common thing, like, people study certain work, like Mark Passio's work, for instance, or, you know, they study certain things and way things have been said, and then they want to just zero in on that's the only way to say things. And I'm not going to talk to people if they disagree with that, or I'm going to start calling them names or something, where we have to really, that's empathy we were talking about, to be a resilient person and be able to put things into context and be able to keep asking, what's the most important thing here? And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how you relate to other people that haven't had your experience, either health-wise, or that don't get what we're talking about when we're talking about truth and freedom and natural law.
This is why I think it's important to take in everything, you know, really like investigate and channel that inner detective and really discern things and investigate everything. Because I don't think one person has the answer to everything. Like, I don't think it's quite possible for that to happen. And
it was my fault because I have a tendency to do this. I talk about a whole bunch of stuff and then I throw out a big ball of questions instead of a single, solitary, simple question, which I guess what I'm asking is, how do you deal with difficult relationships, and not so much online, but people you actually relate to? I think it's kind of the missing ingredient is how do we talk to people that don't see things our way, you know?
Well, okay. Yeah. So I feel it's important to understand where people are at. I think that it is a bit of a fallacy, like where I think that, you know, small percentage of people can take in information and really assess it very quickly and come to an objective truth. I think there are people out there who can, in fact, do that. However, I don't think most of us can do that. And like, we're all in this growing process of trying to figure things out. And I think that's part of the experience of incarnating here in the physical. So I've worked a lot with people in the public. I did that for like 5 years before I even thought about doing really anything online in regards to this kind of work. And I find that everybody, like, they're all in their different places and you can impart information to them if you're good enough. I mean, I shouldn't phrase it that way. If you're paying enough attention to, you know, maybe the needs to those people, I'm not saying hold anything back, but be conscious, have empathy for the place that they are in. So, you know, I have imparted all kinds of information that involve like natural law and you know, medical information and like all sorts of things to people who I know needed it at that time. And, you know, a lot, you know, I've gotten pushback from people, but, you know, honestly, I feel with the method of like kind of meeting people where they're at currently, giving them the information that they're currently searching for, this is how people easily or more easily take in information that they can assess. Like if you try to force things onto people and berate them and harass them and be like, push, you know, like, or embarrass people, that again, I think that works for like this percentage of people. Like that does work on people. It works on people like me, but the majority of people, they can't learn that way. You can't do that to them. They're not going to take it in. And they're just going to reject everything you say and throw it all out. So my method is not about pushing. It's about, here's some stuff to consider. Take it or leave it. Take it or don't take it, you know, and not pushing, because I feel if I'm doing that, I'm just as bad as like any institution trying to force people into thinking a certain way. So I don't operate that way. So when... honestly, the majority of people who I end up talking to in real life usually are people who have had really severe, complicated medical problems or, you know, run-ins with the medical institution that have upheaved their lives in some way. And I mean, we go on hours for some of the horror stories that people have told me. Horror stories. It's worse than horror movies. Like, you think horror movies are bad? Like, this is, it's unreal. It's unimaginable what takes place in the medical institution. So that's usually, I think, just, you know, I feel like that's my place in this expression now, is that with the experiences that I've had in my life, and now understanding what all of that means and where I fit into that, I'm able to help people who are in those positions the most. And that's, you know, where I feel like, and I incorporate, you know, natural law, their inherent rights. I encourage people to always be resilient, always be indomitable, always stand on your feet. And even when you are at the point, even when you're at the edge of that cliff, don't let anything drag you to your knees. So I guess that's how I communicate with people. I communicate through understanding that we are growing individuals internally, and you know, we're here to experience this physical world. And you know, maybe the people who are, you know, resistant to the type of information that any of us, like me or you, Chris, could impart, maybe they're not supposed to understand what we're saying yet. And I consider these things as possibilities, which is why I don't try to force anything. I give people what I share, what I think is important. I try to do that as objectively as I possibly can. And I give people what they ask for. So that, I guess, I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. Think about what I always say. What I always say about, you know, Jeremy Locke's quote, evil is the destruction of freedom. Well, if you could think of freedom as a bunch of options, like look at my tree of life, like every branch is a different option. And every moment we're in, we have all these options. Well, evil's all those things that want to hide those options from you, that want to turn them all black and white and say, there's only two, there's only one option, right? You know, and what does that? Because real life from its source has so many options. There's unlimited choices one could make in a given moment or given day. But the world around us that forms this jail and that winds up helping us make that jail in our own mind starts to cut all those branches and leaves off and be like, no, there's only two. You know, you can have one president or the other president. And those are external forces. And you have to do what they say. They don't want you to recognize that the tree of life represents your own inner Kabbalah of, you know, learning and wisdom and traveling through the different parts of your own soul to learn it. And I think sometimes the trauma like we go through forces us to do that. And maybe that's why we're here. But I can't help but think that the most joy I've get in life is from feeling like I'm proud of my own self instead of feeling like I'm not doing enough or I'm wrong or I'm bad, you know, because that's the way you're kind of trained from school and all the indoctrination. And so for me, it's been a big life change of trying to go through this metamorphosis, even in this world of evil, even in this realm where most people aren't getting along, people seem to have lack the abilities just to have communication and understand what community means. I can still find beauty and I can still find love and I can still find purpose. And that gives me, it gives me drive. It gives me reason to go to the next day and to fight for life. And I really love the title of your book, Addicted to Life. I mean, I think it's so beautiful. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you wound up writing a book and how hard that was. unless you wanted to reply to something else I said, feel free. I know I always say a lot.
No, we could definitely do that. But I would just comment, I think, especially like viewing, you know, looking at the tree of life as an analogy here. Like, I mean, I would say for myself, it's like understanding that there is objective morality in this reality. I would say as well, though, within objective morality, because there's rules here, like, you know, the Hermetic principles, mentalism, correspondence, all of those things, thoughts, emotions, and actions, like these are a part of what I would call objective law, objective morality, like, right, you know, all of this stuff. It's these physical expressions that we're incarnating in that are these subjective aspect of reality. Like, and I think that gets confused a lot with especially in chat, like that's how I kind of feel about that. Like our experience, physical experience, our personal experiences can be subjective because we're all dealing with different things. That's the personal journey. but then, I just wanted to comment on that too. That's how I look at it. But yeah, we can talk about. So I've always been a bit of an advocate in a lot of my adulthood life, an advocate for the just, you know, I started really with just being an advocate for the rights of people with cystic fibrosis. So that's kind of where I really started, because within that community, I felt as somebody who grew up in it as a kid, with my whole childhood in that atmosphere, there's not a whole lot. The way it kind of works is that even though there are people who have good intention, it's a very small community. Even the people who like are doctors or scientists or people who work in that, the majority of those are parents who have kids with CF. A lot of them are volunteers. And they want the best for the people that they love. Like, it is a very, very small community. But the problem with it is, like anything else, it's very publicized in a way with general terminology, because this helps with funding. And, you know, it's all very manipulative in a way. Like, they came out with modulator drugs, which they're like the cure to CF, which is not true. This is a half truth. It's not a cure. Organ transplants, not cures. We don't even have to go into that. That is a filthy, filthy, dirty business right there. Things like, you know, the way it used to be is that they isolate kids and people who have CF from the rest of the world. There's a social isolation that goes on. And it's very, just that aspect alone is very traumatizing. They pair kids up with who have CF with psychologists right out the get-go, because they're going to assume incorrectly, they're like setting you up almost for failure. They're going to assume that you're going to be mentally ill because you're a child who's dealing almost directly with the concept of death. And so it's the psychological, like, you know, undercurrents thing that develops within the person. And then you've got people who grow up and they've got all kinds of problems, you know, and it's very disorientating and very difficult. So my activism, I was trying to focus on, no, these kids are not necessarily unwell and they shouldn't be treated differently and they shouldn't be set up in this manner medically that they're going to be mentally unwell as a result of it. Like, this is poor science. It's bad science and it's abusive and it's a violation of people's rights. And they're doing it, and they do it to kids. They start, you know, I understand the intentions might be good, but so that's where I started. And like, because I saw it firsthand. I know exactly what they're doing. I know what they do. But good intentions lead to the road to hell. So that was where I really started coming out, and like, I started there, really. So then my goal was to help, you know, after I had like under my belt, my life experiences, the experiences other people told me about that they had, you know, a lot of research into the medical world and like how it works socially. And then I started getting into things like Dr. Joe Dispenza, Ernest Holmes, and exploring other avenues of that. And when I started doing that, that was kind of afterwards, after one of my first major situations health-wise, which was in 2008. And a while after that, like 2008 is when I really started to change who I was internally, spiritually, and psychologically. You know, things just changed for me, like, because I was dealing with an end of life situation personally in my life. And so after that, that's when I started discovering things like Dr. Joe Dispenza, Ernest Holmes, and like things of that nature, metaphysical health, metaphysical stuff. And, you know, like being able, I started to come out of the materialistic, you know, one and done, atheist, little bit nihilistic kind of mindset. I started coming out of that. So it all led up to, like, after I like went through all of that stuff, and then I went through a bunch of other real world, external world kind of stuff. And then most recently, after I went through my second difficult, well, really my it's not really the second, but like the biggest situation I've had with my health in end of 2021, like I changed again, and like my perspective grew a little bit more, and with more, you know, it was brighter. The light was brighter. And this is something Ernest Holmes says that I didn't even read until recently, but he says, the light is always the same for everybody. It just depends on the degree of light that individual is currently seeing. So it's something to that effect, not a direct quote, but I just, when I read that, I was like, bingo, I got it.
Like a camera aperture, you know, you can set it, and maybe your life setting on where you're at and what things you've been through, change that aperture setting where all of a sudden, and it kind of brings me back to like, what's the very most important thing in life? It's something I've asked since I was very young. Like, why should we be talking about anything else than the very most important things? Let's start with those things. And I think some of these experiences you're describing brought you there.
Yeah.
To really ask what matters the most, what's really important. Sorry.
Yeah. Exactly. And like, so it was all these things that helped me to really be in a place where I could, to be in a place where I was comfortable writing about these experiences and writing about what I know and how to put, like, the book that I wrote is really just a collection of transcripts. It's not like a timeline of history. It's all over the place, like, really. So, I mean, keep in mind, it's like a collection of transcripts. And so, like, I touch on a lot of different topics. But in regards to actually being in a place where I could feel comfortable in putting out a book like that, that took a lot of that time that I had to experience. And at the end of 2021, I was in probably the worst situation I've ever been health-wise. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, because it's horrific. And like, there's, you know, consequences to that. There's issues that crop up, like PTSD style. And I won't go into it, but I was in a place where everyone thought I was going to die, and I had to be, but what was weird about it is that I wasn't afraid of it. I wasn't afraid. And for the first time in my life, I really, really was not afraid. And I'm sitting there in the hospital room, and funny enough, I had just had this conversation with a guy who I wasn't sure if he's part of the cleaning staff or the kitchen staff at UCLA. And we just had a really great conversation about, you know, metaphysical health, even in spirituality and things like that, and pertaining to the physical world, because he's like, I've seen some shit, you know? So, and it was just a really amazing conversation. And then soon after that, I turned inward and I said inwardly to my high self or source, God or whatever people want to call it, I said, you know, I'm okay. I'm all right with it. I think that if I've produced more than what I think that a lot of people in my position may have produced, I have, you know, done things with my life. Like I had already put out the first version of Addiction to Being Alive, I think, you know, and it was the extended edition after that I did that after, but I was like, I think if I'm remembering, it gets a little foggy sometimes. But I'm like, I've had experiences that were valuable to me that I learned from, even the negative ones, even the ones that were difficult. I have, excuse me. And this is me all talking to myself, my inner self, God, whatever people want to call it, source. I have an amazing daughter who's got her house in order. I've got an amazing husband who fully understands me, maybe the first person to ever really fully understand me in and out. And, you know, I got to marry my best friend. I get to spend my life with my best friend. I've been able to help people out in my community. And I was just like, I'm okay with it. And if this is my time, you know, what's the next step? Where are we going from here? What's the next adventure? Bring it. Let's go. You know, I was okay with it. And that was like, for the first time in my life, I was like really, actually, truly not afraid. And it was painful, and it was very difficult for me to walk or breathe or eat. These are all external physical aspects of that, of experienced life. But my inner self, my real self, we're ready to go. I'm feeling great. You know, so that's where I was. And that kind of like pushed me even further into trying to help, because like it was like this, they're like, we don't know, you know, like I had like severe hypoxic respiratory failure. My lungs were fully impacted. This is what I mean by respiratory failure. My lungs were fully impacted with junk. Like, and I won't go into detail, but let's call it junk, like no space. And I was breathing from this part, like this is all I was breathing out of. And they were able to prove that through x-ray. They could see that. So I know that that's a fact. And I could barely walk. I could barely eat anything. Like it was crazy.
Hits me, Sarah. Oh no, go finish. But it really hits me because I went through some breathing issues before, and that, man, talk about scary. And
it is scary. Yeah, it is very scary. And you're just like, I don't even understand what's happening. But then when I got to that point where, like, you know what, I'm actually okay. I'm okay. And when I did that, not that it's magic or anything, but I was tapping into what I think we can all tap into. When I did that, like that, things changed. And you know how I know that is because the very next day, like I was just saying, like, whatever you got to do, you know, like, you know, if I make it, great. If I don't, let's see what happens. Next adventure, ready to go, right? Like the very next day, somebody rolled into my hospital room a thing called a MediNet. And it's a machine that you use like saline, like basically salt water in, and it blows air into your lungs and it forces your organs to do this, right? So what that does is it forces your organ open. This allows for you to remove things through coughing it out of your body. So I kind of feel like that is a moment in my life where I'm just like, I really turned on in that moment, because I'm a big supporter. I fully believe this. Well, I don't say believe, I know it. Other people need to consider it and figure these things out for themselves, I think. But I know we get what we asked for. I asked for an answer and I got one. And it, like, honestly, it wasn't because of like the antibiotics. I mean, that those play a little bit of a, they play like this much of a role, but really it's because that one tech rolled in that machine. And because of that machine, I was able to empty my lungs out and, you know, make it, you know, survive through it. So I don't know, like, that's just my experience that I had, and everybody's going to be different, but it was just a pivotal moment for me. Like,
I find it to be very inspirational, partly because of my own experience. Like I said, one thing from the Bible I like is when it said, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, the door will be opened. And I wanted to ask you about, like, maybe some insights on healing. And I think that story you just told is like answering that question before I could ever ask it. There's something very real. What I've experienced on a smaller degree, I went through a period of time where I was getting a crazy amount of like phlegm. I'd have to cough up all this snot all the time, and I was trying to figure out what was causing it. Obviously not to the extent that you were, I mean, but I was scared. I like couldn't breathe at night, and I had to start using an inhaler. That was the only way I could get to sleep. And eventually I got on to Wim Hof breathing, and also salt. I felt these salt inhalers and a few other things, changing my diet. But when I started like really doing the Wim Hof breathing, it would bring me to these moments when I would try to lay down flat, because he kind of, that's what he wants to get you towards, get relaxed. But I would feel like I was drowning in my own fluids, and I would get scared and I would get this anxious feeling. And I had to kind of make a deal with myself, like, okay, anytime you feel that, just get up and go for a walk, and we don't have to do it anymore right now. And I would allow myself to just take breaks whenever I needed them. But eventually I would come back and keep doing the breathing, and eventually I had to like push through. I just had to face it, face on that fear. And many times I've laid there in the darkness of my own mind doing breathing techniques and feeling that fear, that of not being able to breathe, and remembering just how scary that is. And I'm still afraid of it. And I hope I can reach what you have, that metamorphosis of someday not feeling that fear and totally being able to look it right in the face. But I think it's very inspirational, and I think it is magic. You said, you know, what you were describing is getting in touch with your source and becoming absolutely okay in alignment with what is, and just acceptance of what the creator and what's going to happen, and not giving up your fuel and your will in the meantime. And that's magic. I think that is what real magic and what real transcendence is, and wisdom. You know, so alchemy, right?
I mean, it is.
Anything else you wanted to say? Go ahead.
It is, in a sense, a kind of magic, but it's what we're creating. It's what we're doing. We're doing this. You know, it's not like somebody else doing it. We do it for ourselves. It is quite. I don't want to dismiss people's experiences, because those experiences are very disarming and traumatic, and they leave scars. But I think it's good to get in touch, you know, with those experiences and not push them aside or ignore them, but dismantle them. Really understand, get to understand them. So why is this happening? Why am I in this position? How, you know, you got to ask all those questions, and it's going to be really hard. It's supposed to be hard. you know, that's.
I think it helps clarify too. One thing I see a lot is that, you know, like in the field we talk in the psychological spirituality realm, people talk a lot about doing the self work or doing the shadow work, but there's not nearly enough, from my point of view, conversation about what that actually is on the day to day. What does that really mean? You know, and I think a lot of the essence of it is starting to understand ourselves for what we are, right? It is of great humility and just kind of saying, look, there's certain aspects of myself that I do certain things and I act certain ways. And even though I want to change them and I want everybody else to see me a certain way, there is also the reality of what I've been doing and what I'm probably going to do. And being able to sort of predict that and see that and feel that and helps you then go forward and modulate it a little bit and curb it. And, you know, if you've got an appetite for something that you know is bad for you, you kind of have to know that. And it's, you can't just get rid of it and just throw it out. It's just going to show up even stronger. You have to kind of like see this part of yourself. And it seems to me that your experience of, number one, almost dying, and number two, of having your body almost completely give up and separate from it, kind of left what's Sarah, you know, I'm what's left. And you were okay with that. And you loved that part of yourself. And when you do that there, I don't think there is a greater healing than that. Does that make any sense how I'm putting that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it was just a process of, it was a moment of shedding the fear of the outcome. I guess that's the only way I know how to describe it, is like I shed the fear of the possible outcome. Like I'm not afraid of, you know, I mean, not that I would hurt myself or like intentionally try to die, but I feel like I'm no longer afraid of that aspect of it. It's just going through the process is, that's what the trauma is. Like that's the issue people have to deal with. So yeah. And I think that's what you're saying. It's just like, I encourage everybody, you know, be fearless, even in, despite whatever comes at you, be fearless, because there's a difference between like being afraid of something and not enacting anything, and being fearless despite being afraid of something.
Yeah. You know, and I think what,
courageous.
Well, what's going on in my mind too, is like that balance between, like we had the shows on what is the ego. And the difference between that part of us that we have pride in ourselves, but then that part of us where we're very humble. And I think the balance of that is so important on this, because people are afraid of being too prideful. They almost think of pride or ego as a completely negative connotation. But in these moments or these times in life when we have to find that grit within ourselves, it's really about getting hold of your pride and saying, I am good. I am worth it. I'm worth fighting for. Yeah. I'm worth trying to breathe another moment for. I am valuable. I'm infused with the spirit of the great all that has given me this life, and that there's nothing more amazing. And so that is a great, wonderful, beautiful type of pride. And yeah, along with it comes with this like kind of undying humility too. Like, yeah, but I also screw shit up and I'm just here walking around like everyone else trying to find out. And yeah, I made a bunch of mistakes, and I take responsibility for them fully. And I'm going to feel the outcome of them, even if it's into whatever the next journey is after this one. I'm ready for that. Let's do it.
Yeah. You know?
I paved this road, and that's fully inhabiting your own self and seeing what your own self is and being able to discern it and support it as its journey, like your own little baby. Right.
That's a great way to put that. That's a great term to use, grit. Like having grit, you know, and moxie, and you know, these are all great terms. Grit, moxie, having a backbone, being resilient, being indomitable, being fearless despite whatever it is that's coming at you. And one of the things that helped me change my perspective, and this was a number of years ago, was when I realized, And of course, this is up for other people's consideration, but I feel like I know that we reincarnate. And once I started looking into that aspect of how reality works, like it's part of, you know, it's part of reality that we reincarnate. I started looking at it from the view that when we incarnate into the physical, we are here to experience and we are here to have these journeys, whether they're good or bad or both. And it's part of the point. It's part of the life, you know, part of life and death. Like it might be even the meaning of life and death. I don't know. Like that kind of is what makes sense to me. Having these experiences in the physical in order to get to the end goal, which is the light, which is objective truth, which is what reality is and how it operates, no matter how that's working for you, which can be totally different. Like, it's just what makes sense to me. And that's what helped me a lot too. When I started looking at it, you know, with that incorporated into like, well, that's, imagine if that was the case. Wouldn't that mean that experience is to be had and not to just throw out? Like that was part of what helped me as well. And like, we actually watched, and usually I wouldn't say like, you know, don't get your information from TV or whatever, but there's a show called, and it's not on the air. It had 6 episodes and then it was taken off the air, which is highly suspect to me, but it was called Ghost Within My Child. And they try to, make it like a paranormal ghost show. And there was a little bit of that in it, but really what the show was these people who were like, you know, scientists, psychologists, people who studied the brain, neurologists and things like that, people who are historians. What it really was were these families who were going through this situation where their like 3-year-old, their 4-year-old, their 5-year-old was talking about their other life. And it usually started with like, oh, you know, like, you know, my other mom. And then that would make the mother go like, what? You know, and then like kind of go crazy a little bit where they didn't want to like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm your only mother. Like, who told you that? Like, you know, but it sent them down these journeys where these kids who could not know certain types of information because they're 5 and they would just tell their parents this. And so it led their parents to, you know, researching more about this stuff. What's interesting about that show is that you could back up everything that these kids said with your own historical research. And that, you know, the proof for reincarnation is the personal experience. So I would suggest everybody see if they can find that. You might be able to find episodes of it.
Yeah, there's a pretty famous story, too, that I've come across of... in Egyptology, a woman who showed up and it was just like that. She claimed she'd been, I don't know, Nefertiti or something like that, and or some Egyptian pharaoh or, you know, high up. And, you know, people all thought she was crazy most of her life, but she had all this information that no one else had. And when mm-hmm. she did wind up getting in those circles with people, like they were hungry for all the information she had, and she had all this stuff. And so eventually she did wind up, you know, being pretty notable researcher on the topic and stuff, because all this information, it's like, well, how do you disprove that? I mean, she knew stuff that nobody else knew and nobody else could get a hold of, and she had the answers.
There's a lot of stories like that. And I do think, I'm not going to say that that isn't true. I do know that there are people who will, you know, claim stuff like that too, because it helps their, you know, yeah. their snake oil salesman. It helps book sales and crap like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that might be, but.
And it might be the case with her, but, you know, maybe there's some, like, little bit of truth in there, too. You know, I don't know, because I'd love to read about that if you have, like,
I can't remember where I came across it, but I've came across similar stories a couple times over the years reading about people. And then when you read near-death experiences, there's like, there's so many books out there and podcasts on near-death experiences. And I mean, there are a lot of stories that have a lot of congruence to them. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's just really being discerning, like, you know, channeling that inner detective and, you know, not just taking everything as fact, but like taking it in for consideration file, like put that in the consideration box in your head. And so you can, you know, really back it up.
Is this the realm of truth or is this the realm of, you know, thoughts and beliefs that I'm playing with? I often ask myself that question or try to say it in the conversation when we're having it, like we did earlier. I'm like, okay, that now we're getting off in Chris's wonder world, you know, which is great sitting around the fire and talking philosophy, but you know what the podcast about and our work and stuff you do is like, well, let's discern it down to truth and what we do know for sure and all those other things. Yeah, we can talk about them and wonder about them, but what really matters is that, you know, we find our autonomy and sovereignty in this world and find a way for humans to not keep enslaving each other on and on and on and on into the future. Which in the context of what we're in right now, we're up against incredible odds of mental minds being shut, eyes being shut, ears being shut to the problem and recognizing the problem. So in our last few minutes here, I'd like you to just talk about what you're doing to deal with that problem of human slavery and the shows and work you're doing and what you got coming up.
Well, well, what I'm primarily trying to focus on really is dismantling medical misinformation, making it as clear and objective as possible for so you know people don't just get sucked into this, that, or the other thing because everybody's looking for some sort of miracle to take place. And I'm like, you really got to just know the information yourself. You have to do this. You have to be personally responsible and really go through it yourself. And it's tedious and it takes a long time. And going through history as well, it's the same thing. You have to really take your time and really dismantle things and read everything and, you know, channel that inner detective and, you know, what actually lines up, what makes sense. So that's mostly what I'm trying to do and, you know, incorporating the aspects of morality and ethics within that and, you know, creating a space for people to be able to tap into that part of themselves to do it. And that's why I always encourage it. And, you know, first and foremost, get your thoughts, emotions, and actions in order up here. Once you do that, you're going to be able to have a much easier time doing it. And it's going to make it easier for people. Like, I promise it will. So I like to encourage research in history, especially, whether it's regular history or general history or medical research history, because I feel like when we have that under our belt and we're doing that kind of thing or really researching and investigating these things, when we understand our history and how our history is operated, then we can understand the situation we are in with a clear lens. We understand what's happening because there's nothing new that they're doing out there. It's all the same tactics. It's always the same game. It's always the same influence, whether or not, whether or not we recognize that or not is what's important. Like, we've got to recognize that it's the same game. And it's over and over again. They don't do anything new. like same old with a brand new package on, you know, covering it, brand new wrapping paper. That's all it ever is. It's always influence. Whether we buy that influence or not is up to us. We've got to get our thoughts, emotions, and actions in order so we don't buy influence. They're selling us. They're selling us a product and we're buying it. So that's how I look at it. And that's what I try to encourage and, you know, keep the doors open and, you know, continue to, you know, adjust the lens there and let the light get brighter and brighter. And just, you know, be in the mindset of being open that way and, you know, not going into these like rabbit holes where it could just lead you into very unhealthy misinformation where you've got like this much right where you're like you're on the level and then you like fall into say something like the flat earth hole. You don't want to do that to yourself. You want to stay open to it all and, you know, dismantle what should be dismantled and investigate, you know, everything and put it all together. This takes time. This takes personal responsibility. And you've got to put the puzzle pieces together. And sometimes, like what happened with me is I was not able to put puzzle pieces together, all these different little things, until I got to a certain point. And I'm not saying I've got all the puzzle pieces, because I don't. There's gaps, obviously. There's always going to be gaps, probably. But I wasn't even able to start putting the puzzle together until I had like 40 years of experiencing the physical. And I think that's for, you know, a reason for myself. I had to go through certain obstacles. I had to have certain experiences that taught me certain lessons. And I think that's like, that's why I think reincarnation is something people should really consider, because we can only be where we're able to be, like, so, and that's a growing process. That's growth.
But being fully inhabiting who we are and where we are, that's the key. And that's the magic of the moment. So
yeah,
I really appreciate this time we've spent today and our conversation. Every time when, you know, I do these recordings for the podcast, I feel like they're for me. You know, I learn a lot and I learn how to say the things I'm trying to say in a better, different way. And then hearing it combined with your perspective and experience, it becomes more, there's more flavor, there's more color. And in a way, it's also kind of the opposite, like you're saying about putting the pieces together. A lot of that is just removing the bullshit, you know, taking the bullshit out until what's left is something that, you know, actually makes sense. So it's like cleaning our windows or, you know, clearing the dishes out of the sink of all the past traumas of our life and the things that are holding us back from being able to look at what's obvious and right in front of us, which is the pure moment right now. And what do we do with that? And how do we feel good about what we're doing with that? So I sure feel good about what we did with it today. And I want people to check out your show, Crosstalk, and your work online on Odyssey. So go ahead and share anything more about your work that you'd like to, and then we'll close it up.
Yeah, I have the radio show, which I go into all kinds of different things, Crosstalk on Revolution Radio, Studio A, and that's 1 to 3 p.m. You can go to the revolution.radio.com website to tune into that live. And, I mean, of course, I have the book, Addiction to Being Alive. I recommend if people wanted to look into that. I recommend the extended edition because it has a fuller scope of that, of those transcripts. And then I just recently published, something that I've wanted to do. And like, it's these experiences too that it have put me in this place where I'm actually able to do it now. And I feel like I can. I'm starting And I just published the first one, a digest magazine called The History Project. So it's on Amazon. It's brand new, History Project, or the History Project Digest Magazine. And what it is small digestible essays that will pertain to history and occultism and spirituality. We've got a lot of great people coming out in the last year, in the next year for the next issues of it. And I can, yeah, here it is. I can show you if you like, Chris. Sure. I just got them in.
Yeah.
It looks like this.
Oh, it's it's all backwards here, but yeah.
Oh, cool. It's the very first episode or issue.
History Project Digest Magazine. Fantastic.
Yeah. So it's meant
Corey
to
be on the cover there?
Yes, it is. It's Corey Enderlot here.
Right on.
Who put in an excerpt from his book, Slavery Gone for Good, which you can also find on Amazon. And the idea behind it that I'm hoping will help is that they are short essays, digestible historical situations, kind of in lieu with the original Reader's Digest, which was like all fiction.
I remember Reader's Digest.
Yeah. So my idea was that let's do this based on history and reality and morality and ethics. So that's the idea. Cool. I'm open for submissions for it, and people can, you know, put something in, submit something. But my hope is to focus a lot on history, because, and that it's family friendly, so that we can give this to our kid and, you know, here's some history for you to learn.
Yeah. About.
So that's the idea. And that's like a lot of my main goal for this year. And hopefully the next couple of years is building that. Because I do feel like history is very important. And when we know our history, then it's a lot easier to operate the world today.
Yeah. And children, boy, do we got to reach the children and the young people. That's so important out there, folks. So yeah, and then you got your Substack.com too. So I recommend people get on, if you're not on Facebook, make friends with Sarah, because you always post your Odyssey channel and your Rumble channel and your Substack all there. So
on the One Great Work Network too. I keep all of them. And the Substack and the One Great Work Network are I'm able to actually put in more of the written content. So I do encourage those two platforms more so, just because it goes along with written content a lot of the time. And there's some extra things there too that I can't do with Rumble or Odyssey. So that's, I enjoy those platforms probably the best, because it really allows me to express openly more thoroughly, I should say.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, a lot of feel for inspiration. You've done so much work and you keep been so busy doing all these things. So I hope that inspires other people to help pick up the slack for the rest of humanity who are kind of dragging behind on their own relative journeys that they're on. But those of us here that are awake and aware, I'm very appreciative of what you're doing, Sarah. And you inspire me, and I know you're going to inspire our listeners, and I'll look forward to watching this chat in a couple of weeks. So we'll see y'all then.
I appreciate you bringing me on, and I hope everybody enjoyed it and that I made some kind of sense.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and I can't wait to see your book, Chris. You got to get that out.
Yeah, we're getting close. We're down to about a month. So,
excellent.
All right, Sarah, much love. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris.